where the interaction with students happens. And so I think what we are finding in AAP is that the kind of curricular work that's happening within departments is, it, you know, really depends on discipline, which I'm sure we're all going to be reflecting. There is in AAP an effort being made because our three departments are all part of a similar professional sort of ecology in a way. Architects, planners, and artists tend to work together out in the professional world as well. And so what we're also looking to do is create some college-wide kind of courses which bring our three disciplines together and bring the question of diversity into them. So I'll stop there. I can talk endlessly about this because I co-chair the council, so I see every piece of it that sort of is happening. And we're having, you know, so the first set of reports just came in this Sunday. So I can talk a lot about sort of the difference in the ways in which each unit is handling this. But we're making changes at two levels, departmental and college.
Okay. Stacy, you're in anthropology, I think, right?
I am in anthropology. Am I?
You're unmuted.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, so far we've been mostly addressing this at a graduate level. And so part of the reason I joined the call was to see what people are doing at the undergraduate level. But at a graduate level, we've started with a faculty graduate student course that is all year long, in which on Fridays we are reading texts together. And they're being co-led by faculty graduate student teams each time. And part of that idea was that there were some comments from graduate students that they weren't getting the kind of readings they needed, particularly in the core seminars, the theoretical seminars, even if there was a lot of issues being talked about in specific seminars. And so instead of at least immediately dictating what people needed to teach in the core seminars, the thought was that we would do some learning together. And that we would read together so that as people took up those core classes, they would feel more comfortable in integrating different texts that they might be less familiar with.
So do I have this right? So in the audience, in the graduate level course, are TAs who are then going to run sections of standard?
No, so this is just about our graduate level teaching. So these are the core seminars for our graduate students. They take one each semester for the first four semesters. So our explicit initiative right now is really for our graduate students because that there's been there was a lot of energy around requests for that. So we haven't really, to my knowledge, I'm the DGS, so I don't really know if there's secret underlying things happening with the DUS, but to my knowledge, we have not yet addressed issues around undergraduate teaching. Not that we don't need to, we just have a sort of more immediate set of demands on the table for our graduate students.
I see. So nothing on course content, so to speak. It's more about how...
Well, the idea is that these things will be shifted into the course content, that we need to rethink our canon and who gets taught in the seminar that are the canon. So the people that get taught when some people teach this course seminars are mostly white men. You know, and they go back to the 1920s and they claim philosophy and social theory as well as anthropologists. So one of the questions is how do we reimagine our canon for Cornell anthropology at the graduate level?
I see.
So that's content, but it's a bigger question than just adding in a few articles.
So how does it, like, a basic tension is that, like, I'm teaching a class and, you can sort of outline what the syllabus is, but, I'm going to make the final call. How do you navigate that kind of a tension? In other words, the faculty member sort of has the prerogative to set things up, but how is the message sent from, like, like this group that you mentioned, to an individual faculty member? How is that going to be received and so on? How do you deal with that?
Yeah, we don't know. That's why we've started with this year-long class, I would say, because we have a lot of say over our individual classes, right? And none of us want to be dictated to about what individual readings, weeks, or assignments are going to look like. So it seemed important first to develop a broad conversation about why this is important, what's important, read things together, feel motivated by teaching it that way. One of our faculty members that's taken on a core class called the History of Anthropological Thought has actually completely redone that class in a really dramatic way and started with issues of what it means to reread every text. So even as they read the canon, they read it through issues of post-coloniality, anti-racism. So she will have established a set of conversations in her class, but as a larger department, we feel we need to educate each other first and create some excitement about it before we start dictating learning objectives or particular texts.
So like I grew up in computer science and whatever, and a lot of the sciences, like, you know, ideas start at the graduate level and they percolate down to the undergraduate level. So that is sort of the same dynamic going on, would you say, in anthropology?
You know, it's a good question, Charlie. I think part of what happens at the undergraduate level for anthropology is we read more anthropology, which tends to have which talks about issues happening all over the world. And so it's an easier effort to put those sort of topical questions into our undergraduate classes. So while it's important, it seems perhaps at one level, on the most superficial level, more manageable. For our graduate level core classes, we're really reading key social theory that's influenced the rise and movements in the discipline. And people feel like it's harder not to teach some of those. That seems like the harder nut to crack.
I kind of have a question. Sorry to pick on you here, but
right on the spot.
When you say the canon, okay, now that seems to me like, is that code for requirements? Or when you elevate something to the canon, it means like this is going to be damn hard to change if it's canon. I mean, like, how do you guys use that word?
Wow. It is hard to change. I think that's why it's the hardest nut to crack for us, right? It's like, it's those people that get cited so often. That we want our graduate students to know when books are in conversation with those people, right? Whether it's Evans Pritchard or Foucault or whoever, right? So you want your graduate students educated when they read a book, but you don't want them to sort of read them at face value, and you want to put other people into that. Who else do we insist that our graduate students have to know? To be well-educated people. And I think you're right. It's not an easy question. I don't have an answer for you. And it's not easy to choose 10 books and just slot them in and tell everybody they have to teach them. It's a bigger disciplinary conversation.
Okay, that's helpful. I'm going to need some help to keep this going here. So listen, why don't we talk to cows? I see Max and Brian and others, Sue. Can you sort of tell me, CALS has been very, perhaps more than other colleges, sort of systematic on, like, in terms of your diversity requirement and so on. And maybe it would be good if you shared this internal workings within CALS, how you figure out courses to put on that list, how you identify shortcomings in your curriculum lineup and do something about it. I wonder if you could, someone could speak to that.
Charlie, I can start that conversation, but there are a few others online here who can add to that, and feel free to jump in whenever you want. We have a diversity and inclusion committee for probably over 30 years. I don't even know when I started, but it's a committee that discusses diversity and inclusion issues of faculty, staff, undergraduate, graduate students, postdocs, you know, the whole gamut. It's really gotten a shot in the arm in terms of activities in the last year and a half or so, in that the college created a new associate dean position at 50% that Chelsea Speck is part of now, or she's holding that position. So she's facilitating that committee, and they're doing a lot of things, including having a diversity lead person in each of the departments there. In terms of the human diversity course requirement, that started probably somewhere around 20 years ago. And we're continually adding courses to that, to the list. There are some in our college, some in arts and sciences, and credits. There's a subcommittee of the college curriculum committee that that reviews course proposals where there's a request to have it on our diversity list. So they make a decision as to whether or not it should be included. And that's based on a definition. They have a definition of what it means to be marginalized and so forth, and certain criteria that they use to determine which courses go onto that list that will satisfy or fulfill that human diversity requirement for the students. And I should say that I know Brian Chabot sent you a message a few days ago. He's been leading a subcommittee of the College Curriculum Committee for the last year that's been, or had been meeting every other week for the two last semesters. And they've essentially proposed a revision of our college learning outcomes and our distribution requirements. So one of those learning outcomes has to do with human diversity, but they've extended that to also include cultural diversity. So what the proposal is to have, to continue to have a requirement of at least one course in human diversity, but add to that a second course that will be on cultural diversity, where we encourage students to participate and study abroad, or maybe it's a course that spends a week or two internationally, or whatever the experience might be, to get that cultural exposure. So that's going through the Cal's Faculty Executive Committee, and we'll go through a faculty review and possibly a vote before that's actually implemented. But that's where we are with it, and that we're expanding the whole thing there. Right. So I don't know if anybody else has some things that you want to add to or in Cal's.
The only thing I would say is that if people are interested, I could put the proposed learning outcome in chat, given that it hasn't been approved by the college, but it shows you what we're thinking. Would that be okay, Don?
Well, sure. Yeah.
Incidentally, this is recorded and also the chat, and we'll post everything online, so nothing will be lost there. But how do you, when you look at a course, so we're talking about rearranging some of our courses, making them better and so on. You must have a criteria for something getting on your list. So if you look at like freshman writing seminar, they're real formulas. You know, this course has to have so many pages of writing spread over this, you know. You talked about outcomes. It means must have a way of measuring things. How do you measure whether a course is over the line here and can count in this particular way? I'm quite mystified by that.
I mean, I should have pulled up on my computer what the criteria are. It's spelled out in writing, but the course has to have at least 50% of its content that has something to do with human diversity. I mean, that's a very general thing, but in terms of percentage of the course, that's what the cutoff is. But again, there's a very detailed definition of what we mean by human diversity as well as marginalized people. And they go, you know, they essentially stick to that a set of criteria to judge whether or not a course should be there. So it's a pretty rigorous thing. Sometimes it takes a little while to determine that. Oftentimes the hang up is that if a student thinks that there ought to be a course that's on that list, they'll make that request. But we want to be able to see a syllabus from the instructor, and sometimes that's hard to get, both within Cornell, but especially outside of Cornell. Sometimes it's hard to get instructors to respond and provide a detailed list of what their topics are. But without that, the committee makes no decision. They need to see specifically what the content of the course is.
Okay.
So Don, just so I understand, so you actually accept courses from students from outside Cornell?
Yes, we do, because Cornell has like one third of our students are external transfer students.
That's right. Yeah.
So they might have already had what they consider to be a human diversity course when they come here. So they can actually submit a request for our subcommittee to determine whether or not that will fulfill the requirement. But again, we need to be able to see the syllabus and run that by the criteria.
If I could just ask another question, and I see that Tim's on the call, Tim Baird. You know, one of the challenges that we're facing in AAP, which I think something that landscape architecture would be facing too, is the manner in which we teach itself. So, you know, so the in studios, in workshops, we teach by through engagement. And the way in which we teach is something that students are pointing out as being disrespectful of diversity. So it's not just the content, it's the form of the class and the way in which, you know, one delivers critique, one teaches students to accept critique. And I find that quite fascinating because it's about sort of the pedagogical structure of the class, not just the content, right? So I'm very curious, and Tim just left, so maybe he doesn't have anything to say on it, but I am curious if other, like I can see engineering facing that same challenge as well, you know, so I just wanted to throw that issue out there as well. Mardell.
Yes, I'm from design environmental analysis, so we have design studios, and I am trying to think what that might mean. It can be disrespectful. Is it particularly disrespectful of different cultures? I'm trying to think about what that would look like exactly. But I mean, there's no question that faculty can sometimes be abusive in the studio situation. Can you say a little bit more about things that might happen in a studio?
Yeah, so there's two kinds of, I've started to kind of think about it in my head as content and form in a way. And so one part of it is always content, and we've been all talking about it, right? How do we define it? How do we sort of describe what the cuts will be? And so in the studio context, it's often the way the project itself is laid out. And so it sort of goes, so that's one part of the content question. The form question is, in critique, what happens when you have a student who's experience is very different, or your from the instructors, and when that is brought to the table, the instructor can be, like you said, abusive. But abusive is the wrong, it's too extreme a word, but the idea of critique,
insensitive,
and insensitive is too light a word. I mean, it's in the middle, but I think the issue is really of when the instructor cannot actually gauge the lived cultural reality of this person, of the student who's bringing that to the table when they're creating solutions, and how do we then start to really think about engaging with that student when you're so very different?
Now, Nima, CTI has that their, I can't remember what they call it anymore, but it used to be called Faculty Diversity Workshop. And I participated in that maybe 6 or so years ago. It was really very good. It's changed a lot since then.
It's truly excellent. But you know what it does? I mean, I did one some time back as well. What it does is touch so much on sort of those of us who teach workshops, studios, engage in, like, you know, in engineering, they have the various kind of project-based studios. So there's a pedagogical engagement there that goes a little further than what CTI does currently. Maybe, not currently, but about 2-3 years ago. Maybe they've changed their things. But I just wanted to throw that out there. Didn't want to hijack this conversation.
But it makes me think about mentoring, really, right? Because that's what the studios are about. And so I wonder if there are some programs or some information or training within the graduate school who's focusing a lot on trying to develop better mentors that could be applied to faculty who are teaching in studios.
No, actually that's a really good point. But Kiara?
I would just say about the whole idea of studio critique, I think we've come a long way from the old sort of master apprentice model where the designer, you know, you did what he wanted you to do, right? There was no give and take, no real discussion. And one of the things that I think we've started to do pretty well is to bring in a lot of visiting critics that, you know, show diversity in the field so that students can get feedback, from, people who look like them or who maybe would understand their culture a little bit better. The other thing is, I think it's just, I was in school 40 years ago, so a lot has changed. And one thing that's changed is, there was one woman in 5 years of my undergraduate school, and now, the profession is changing, so there's more women. So that's a great positive. And I think it's incumbent on each studio critic that they, do two things. They provide constructive criticism, but they also have to supply some sort of encouragement, and you have to balance it. And, I've seen, people that, when I was at Harvard that, they're just mean, and they don't mind sort of destroying a person, in front of everybody. I think we've gotten away from that, not completely probably, and then maybe I'm naive, but I think it comes down to individual faculty of, understanding that they have a role to help encourage people and to provide as much understanding as possible and understand that people have different views and different worldviews when they come from different parts of the world.
So let me just jump in then, Chiao. So Tim, like within you're in landscape architecture, when you see something like from President Powell, like we want you to rethink the curriculum or whatever, with these sorts of things, how you go about criticism, is that something that's an ongoing conversation, would you say, in your unit? Or is it these changes have been over time? Like you, I went to school like 50 years ago, so I know there's a long timeline here and things have evolved. But is that an active topic within your unit?
Yes, we did a town hall for all the department, and we had some alumni there as well to discuss the current issues, racism and police brutality, and that has continued. And the group has come up with a summary report of some of the suggestions that students primarily have made about how we address our curriculum, how we from studios to our history theory courses. Landscape architecture history has been highly Eurocentric. But in the last 20 years, we've included much more of the rest of the world. And, certain people have been left out. Women were left out in the early history books. That's changed. People of color. We have a group nationally called the Black Landscape Architects Network that a couple of our alumni were instrumental in forming. And so we're taking some of the things that they're working on and bringing it into our curricula. I've asked each faculty member, in addition to, we're currently reviewing the summary document that this working group put together, but I've also asked each faculty member to specifically describe in a paragraph or two what they see as the changes they need to make in each one of their course syllabi. And, it's very clear in history what we need to do. Studio, we're addressing those issues, but that's a little bit more difficult to sort of get our head around at this point. But it is, it's a ongoing discussion.
I have a question. You brought up alumni, which seems really interesting. So was this discussion folded into normal alumni summertime conversations, or did you go after alumni with a point, on this particular topic in isolation? Because I just realized that's a tremendous source of a great feedback, how the alumni think about their experience here. They've been out 5-10 years and whatever, and they're paying attention to our current campus concerns, and their thinking would be extremely valuable. How did you go about getting that again? Was it just a normal alumni chit chat or what?
Well, no, they, everyone was invited to this working group town hall that we had in June. And it just so happens that I'm not sure we actually did invite the alumni, come to think of it. I think they just heard about it. And a couple from the last year or two were involved, and they're new in their job, and you know, they were interested to relay what their experiences had been, you know, in a professional office. And there's a lot of issues surrounding that, you know, whether we as a department should be tasked with policing all the professional offices in the world to sort of tell our students, you know, you shouldn't go there, you should go there. My approach has always been to, you know, point out, you know, yes, this office does great work. They're part of the canon that was mentioned earlier, you know, the precedent quality work that we always hold up to our students as high quality. But then maybe that office, you know, is all white, maybe it's all male. Students are starting to question that, you know, is that the kind of firm that we need to be sending people to? And so that's a really tough issue, especially if it involves an alumni that has been very supportive, and we're actually having to deal with that issue, which, you know, on top of everything else, has made life a little bit difficult in the last few days. But we've also, one of the things that we need for accreditation next year had been suggested a couple of times is some sort of alumni advisory board or some way to reach out to alumni and involve them. And so that's something that I plan to get started next semester.
Very good. Shara, you had your hand up for a long time. You must be tired.
Fortunately, it's virtual, right? Thank you. I wanted to say two things. One about is CTI courses. I've never been super fond of CTI, being a humanities person who mostly teaches small classes, but I think that their inclusivity workshop for faculty was great. And now they're running a thing is called a Teaching and Learning in a Diverse Classroom, which is asynchronous, and they do cohorts. Like, they could do a cohort for faculty who teach studio classes. And so you would have like a dedicated facilitator who actually looks into the specific challenges that you have. And I know that they do this tailoring thing because I was looking for some opportunities for our graduate students in the department, in my department, which is Asian studies. And we do kind of niche thing, as each department has its own niche. And so they seem very eager to kind of to come out and meet the needs of faculty and students. The other thing, it was maybe more of a question, and I think Nima just brought it up again in the chat, which is, you know, I was very interested in what Anthro is doing, which is a seminar in which students and faculty come together as this moment of self-reflection, of rethinking the canon, and how do we teach the canon in it through new critical lenses. And but, you know, how do you reach out to the faculty? Like, you know, you mentioned there are some faculty who have been known to be abusive or extremely critical and mean in the studio setting. And we have this faculty in every discipline, whether it's studio or non-studio. How do you make them realize that that's really not okay, and get them to go through training so they understand that that's not, you know, the corporate world, that would be totally acceptable that a manager picks an individual and say, well, Asha, you need to do training. Like we ended up doing with harassment, sexual harassment, but this does not apply because in the classroom, the teacher is king or queen of the castle. How do we break through that and make people understand that this is really like not okay? I mean, I know it's more of a question, but it's clearly a really important issue to deal with if we want institutional change. We're each just looking at changing our own curriculum, like, you know, the group that we are here, we're talking and we appreciate the core, but, you know, how do we go beyond that? I don't have an answer, but I think it's an important question.
Well, it's tricky. I mean, it surfaced in the Senate a week and a half ago, 2 weeks ago, you get the free speech. You know, I think, first of all, I think some faculty resent, you know, the know-it-all kind of thing. What do you mean I have to be trained? And then that, you can't force me to take this training. But, you know, in the biology circles, right, if you run a lab that has animals or human subjects and so on, you have to take training, and it's not an infringement on your your free speech or anything like that. It's about a safe environment, which is exactly the same thing we're kind of talking about here. So, but that is a challenge. I guess we're getting very, which is good. We're getting thinking very broadly here. That's one of our challenges in the working group that's concerned with faculty, you know, an educational program for faculty. How do you pull that off? It's easy to, you know, preach to the choir. How do you get the others to pay attention? And that's a major challenge. So,
Charlie.
Yeah, Brian.
This is obviously a complex problem that has been with us for a long time. So there are a bunch of different answers to that. But relating to the anti-racism, diversity stuff that we're dealing with, a lot of departments and even laboratories and individual professorial groups are coming up with their own statement of a purpose and a statement of moral philosophy about these issues. And it certainly would bridge into the cover the kind of behavior that we're discussing here. So encouraging more groups to at least state what the way they should be treating other people helps to set a different tone.
Yeah, I mean, peer pressure is one of the most powerful pressures around it, and it's very intense at the department level. As you get bigger and, you know, bigger circles, it's not quite so effective. So I guess in a way, we should applaud individual labs and departments for making their own specific statements. I think that's a powerful
thing. Yeah. And I think if you did a survey, you'd find quite a large collection of these popping up within the last few months.
Right, yeah. Well, this gets back to, we have a webpage that has sort of very high level, here's what the colleges are sort of working on right now. But I'd love to, maybe this involves cruising through all 90 department websites and picking these things off to see them collectively would be really useful. Maybe that's something we just have to do. Yeah, Nima.
Charlie, I want to ask, Brian, I have a question. When you said there are these kinds of collective statements, are you talking about labs? Are you talking about disciplines, like disciplinary associations, professional associations putting out statements? What are you talking about?
Well, I was looking mostly at what's going on at Cornell. So these are predominantly departments.
Okay. Yeah.
And then lab group. Don and I were in a meeting last week, I guess it is now, that where a faculty member went through the individual lab group statements, and there were quite a large collection within this one department where the lab groups were on their own coming up with statements of principle about how they should be treating each other and how that lab group would embrace diversity.
Yeah.
And so on. So, and my department is doing that at the department level. Another department I'm associated with is doing that at a department level. So these things will filter out eventually.
Yeah, very interesting. Susie from the vet school, so you deal exclusively with graduate level students. Would you want to share a little bit what's going on over there?
Sure, but there's also, we're well represented here. I've got the chair of our Belonging Cornell committees on, and I'm going to toss it to her, but I'll start. We've also got the chair of our curriculum committee on this call. So, so of course, you probably know that we're in the whitest profession that exists, apparently, in the United States, and so we are already battling that. Before all this really got so inflamed, we had started monthly meetings, dialogues that the dean pretty much made sure that he was at, or at least one a representative from the college leadership was present. And it was dealing with these sorts of topics, including, you know, getting back an alum with disabilities or an alum of color, and sort of some of the telling their story a bit and sort of, you know, bringing some really critical issues to the front. The problem is, as a few of you alluded to, is the people that went to those really were the people that really didn't need to be there. We had trouble drawing in the audience that really needed to be there. We have had combined our old affirmative action and diversity committees into one with representatives of, into one Belonging Cornell committee with representatives professional students, faculty, college leadership, and staff. And Antonio Jameson Jordan is on this call, and she's the current chair and has really energized the group. And so I'll see if she's anything to add, but we've the things we've been working on are these monthly meetings are gonna start again in the fall, small group discussions, alumni mentors and and alumni panels. Our alumni affairs group is working on scholarships for underrepresented minority groups, students. The dean has done a town hall most weeks, not just covering this topic, but also updates on COVID and things of that nature. We've been criticized, and rightly so, probably for the college leadership being not diverse, and we're working on that as well. And then our hospital director has had weekly alumni information sessions about COVID, about the hospital, about how we're dealing with clients that are not allowed in the hospital and are sort of this sorts of thing. And that has also sort of made a bridge to the alumni to some extent. So that's what I can think of. And Antonio or Pete, Ricardo, also on this call, I see. You guys have anything to add?
Well, I think that Pete Scrivani, as head of the curriculum committee, should probably address how diversity and cultural competency are going to be incorporated into the curriculum formally. But I will also say we've had a lot of energy from students and a lot of suggestions from students about how to make the curriculum more inclusive in terms of representation and making sure that we're acknowledging contributions of people from all cultures. And but in terms of actually teaching cultural competency, why don't I bounce it over to Pete, who can talk about how it fits into our competency-based framework.
Hello, everyone. So I attended this meeting because we're just at the beginning, and I don't know if we have anything concrete to report on yet. The curriculum committee was undergoing a reinvention of itself and trying to figure out how we want to provide oversight of the curriculum when COVID happened and then when these issues became appropriate. And one of the problems that we had is the way in which we were evaluating the curriculum was very horizontal. We could evaluate the different years of the program very well, but we didn't do a very good job of integrating it across the 4 years or taking into account the extracurricular or the whole college experience, because certainly the process of getting a DVM isn't just limited to the curriculum. So we are in the process of trying to establish these domain management groups. We have recently adopted a competency framework and defined the competencies that a veterinarian should have in order to be a veterinarian. And one of those competencies relates specifically to the practice of inclusivity and promoting diversity. So what we're doing now is we're identifying these domain management groups that are gonna look at the curriculum across the 4 years and the extracurricular experiences, and then report back to the curriculum committee. And then we are going to take that information and make changes to the curriculum. Ricardo, who's on this call, is been, we're piloting this process with our first group, which is gonna take on diversity as our major issue that we're gonna look at this year. So that's about where I can say, as Antonia mentioned, we did have a very robust and active student group that provided a lot of suggestions for how to incorporate this into the curriculum. And I'm hoping, you know, that the next steps, actually we're having a meeting in 2 days that hopefully is gonna start this off. Ricardo, do you have anything you wanna add to this? apparently he doesn't have a microphone. So Antonio or Susie, did you have anything you wanted to add to that?
No, thanks. I'm good.
No, thank you.
Okay, that's a good snapshot of what's going on in the vet school. Nancy Wells, human ecology.
Hi, folks. My sense in human ecology is that our units have put together teams. They each have a diversity committee and some leadership there. I think there's some variability in terms of how much they've started to delve into the curriculum and that charge. I think some folks are looking at, you know, what they're delivering, even just looking at the images that they have in their PowerPoint slides and trying to pay attention to the diversity that's represented in those presentations. But I'm intrigued by some of what Peter talked about, this idea of, you know, essentially kind of a curriculum mapping model, which is what I hear about sort of the strategy that Engage Cornell uses. We're engaging now with Engage Cornell as a pilot college soon. And that notion of sort of looking across your major and where are the different engagement opportunities that are both curricular and co-curricular. And I feel like that sort of notion might be sort of a useful model to layer onto this anti-racism or diversity kind of lens for our curriculum. So that's just a couple thoughts, but some of the folks that are in my college that are actually on the ground trying to make this happen are here. So maybe Mardell can tell us more what she's up to.
So we sort of create a process over the summer. We invited our alumni, emeritus faculty, students, everybody to jump in and try and think about ways we might do a series of things, including enhancing our curriculum, and created a summary document, which our graduate student association turned and helped us create something we call the DA anti-racism timeline. And there are a variety of actions that we just didn't want to have recommendations or a variety of actions. There's a whole theme, sort of thesis around this, about vigilance, economy, universality, and longevity. And then we had specific tasks associated with this, and they included things like each faculty member was requested that they report how they might have modified their curriculum this semester or how they might want to modify it in the future. It was voluntary to participate, and some people did and some people didn't. Sometimes it was things, as Nancy was mentioning, enhancing racial literacy by including additional references as part of our course content, or we do a lot of visuals. So do our images incorporate underrepresented groups? A big push towards that. Every faculty meeting we have now, our diversity group is our entire faculty. And so every faculty meeting we have, we spend the first 45 minutes talking about issues of diversity, and we actually have an agenda of items that we're trying to cover. We also, the department anteed up to bring a series of speakers into one of our courses that represent diverse perspectives. And they have done, we've had two lectures so far on that topic. So we're dealing with it at a variety of levels. As I heard people talking about trying to introduce new courses on this topic, I'm thinking that we have a faculty position that's open. I think that's the type of class that we'd probably bring in with that new faculty member. That seems a good way to operate, in addition to having people sort of think through their classes a little to see how they might expand them. But we have lots of documentation on all of this, and a lot of credit goes to our graduate students for engaging, because they actually participate in this 45 minutes of our faculty meeting, so they can provide their views as well. So that's just DEA.
Thank you. Sarah.
Yeah, hi. So I'm in a little bit of a unique position because I'm the DUS for the newly forming Department of Global Development. So we were able to sort of take this time and really rethink what our core curriculum was going to look like, and in light of that, plan accordingly. And one of the things that we were able to do was get everybody to agree to the fact that for the core courses, we are going to have at least agreement on the learning outcomes. And so you can explicitly in all these courses have pieces that relate to questions of, you know, colonial legacies and diversity and all those kind of issues. And the curriculum committee is tasked with sort of reviewing these courses as they come in. So we just had our first meeting and we're starting this process, but it's really nice to be able to kind of think about this holistically and comprehensively. And you know, one thing that we're doing is we have a first year seminar course that we're putting together for our freshman students, right? And historically for courses like this, you know, it's, they'll have somebody from Learning Strategies Center or the Learning Center come in and help kids with like how to study, right? So we do that, but we then also at the same time are gonna be reading like a commentary by Anthony Jack, who's a scholar who talks a lot about racism in educational systems, right? And so by thinking about these things sort of all together at the freshman level on up, I think it'll work pretty well, or I'm pretty excited about it.
We've talked a little bit, Nima and I, with the freshman writing seminar or whatever. So how does Cal's students take one freshman writing seminar? Well, what's your rule at that level?
Oh, this is just a freshman course. Sorry. This is like a freshman intro course for us.
Hey, can I just ask a question, Sarah? So most of our majors have an introductory course, right?
So this is an additional course. We call it the freshman cornerstone.
Okay.
So we have a big intro to global development course where in there we tackle, you know, the sort of material, right? And the material is very related to these issues, and so that works. But even in our sort of seminar where it's how to get to know each other, how to study, how to, you know, do well at Cornell, we're trying to bring some of that training, the anti-racism perspectives in that, which has historically just been more sort of how to write a resume, right? But sort of bringing some of those activities, those more critical takes into those efforts, I think is something that would probably work across different departments, because it's not, you know, big extra content lift, but it's a way to sort of bring in questions of diversity and inclusion in ways that are still useful for students.
So is this a 2-credit class or a 3 or 4? Two.
And is this something that's new, or is something that replaces something? Has the volume of requirements gone up for your students?
So this is new. We had the Department of Development Sociology and the International Ag and Rural Development major, and those are going away. So we're winding those down. We're launching the Global Development major. And so with that, it's a lot, but it's also kind of great because we get to start fresh, and also kind of everybody who wants to teach in the core, where we have some sort of oversight of what's happening in terms of learning outcomes, has to just kind of agree to it. And that's part of it. If you don't want to teach in the core, fine, you can teach electives, but it's our way to kind of have some guide rails on what's happening within the major.
So this is interesting, Charlie. This is a different, slightly different strategy. So there's, you know, and Charlie and I talking to people, and thank you everybody so much for joining this call, because we're finding two different strategies. There's one group of departments, like the AAP departments, like what Sarah's talking about, which are really going after the core and trying to bring questions of anti-racism, colonialism, precarity to the core. And then there's another group of departments that are relying much more on just sort of educating faculty and hoping that it starts to spread across. And ideally, of course, we should be doing both. But I think with limited time and energy, we tend to focus on one or the other. But it's sort of interesting, the two distinct strategies.
Yeah, so I think that, so I mean Asian studies, and I think we're trying to do, I don't know, actually I kind of like how you were trying to characterize the two polars, but I was like, where are we? Which side of it? Because we are currently revising our mission statement to be more explicit about, you know, inclusivity and equity in education, and how Asian humanities are also about understanding issues of marginalization, Blackness in a more general sense, not just in the North American context, for example, indigeneity and these kind of questions, but then also tackling learning outcomes So revising learning outcomes to list some that, again, go to social justice and being, you know, not just having critical skills, but critical skills to analyze not just cultural diversity, but issues of inequality, right? So being more intentional about the language that is in the learning outcomes that usually is fairly vague and is intentionally vague because you want to be inclusive of faculty that does all sorts of things. But so we are trying to, we're kind of taking the top-down approach and hoping that gradually various faculty will, from the bottom up, kind of come and meet those new learning outcomes. We can't fire anybody, and hopefully also people who do, you know, very abstruse, like pre-modern, weird, niche things will be able to relate to having a learning outcome, which is Asian studies relate to understanding just the, you know, social inequality in the United States in one way or another, but it's kind of this combination of sandwiching goals. I don't know. Again, I really don't know how individual faculty will respond in a practical way in changing their syllabi, but again, it goes back to my earlier point that we're trying to kind of do a top-down mechanism, which on the medium run might force people to do those individual changes at the syllabus level. I don't know.
Thank you, Tim. Magda, how are you? And Magda teaches in Near East Studies. She teaches Arabic. I'm just wondering, you've taught here for a number of years. How are things, what are you seeing from your classroom, so to speak? And how is your department perhaps thinking about some of these issues? Sorry to put you on the spot, but I know you have...
No problem, Charlie. Thank you. And hello, everyone. So I think, you know, this is something we continually discuss in my department, and even more so recently, you know, given what's going on these days. Some of the things definitely we have started doing is inviting diverse speakers and, you know, to come and share what they work on and just kind of discuss that. Also on an individual level, you know, that's one of the things that I think we each continue to work on individual level, like the syllabus. How can we make the, you know, our syllabus even more diverse? It could be anything from what is it we're teaching, you know, the content to how we're teaching it, how we're presenting it. And even speaking of content, I'm currently working on a textbook, you know, as I review other textbooks, I see hardly any diversity. Even someone mentioned the pictures you choose, how diverse is the textbook itself. So we try to promote that in our classrooms. One of the things I also find out is that, sorry, I just realized that my video is off. Here I am. I think what I'm finding, I teach language. So in my classes, I have very diverse students. And one of the things I really enjoy and have been doing is, I guess, harnessing the students and their background for my pedagogy, okay, as I'm teaching. I like to bring the students' background and cultural background, linguistic background, to, I guess, incorporate that into my teaching. For example, I may have a student from Spain, and I may show them the relationship of, or the interactions of Muslims and Arabs in old Spain, and the language, how the Arabic has influenced Spanish and vice versa. And students find that very, very interesting because they see that where they come from has value to what I'm teaching. Right. So, you know, little things here and there, but, you know, I believe we all need to be aware of that. We have a lot of work that needs to be done, and just to be aware and also take knowledge. I guess the last thing I say is, yes, like I said, acknowledge the students and where they come from and be sensitive to that. Right. Be sensitive to them and their cultural backgrounds. And also, rather than seeing it as something that kind of is, I don't know, different or not acceptable, see it more like, oh, here's an opportunity, here's something to include these students. Yeah, so that's all I have to say for now.
Do you see the different, like, so you probably teach at different levels, like Arabic 1, 2, and 3. Do you see a difference as you go up the scale there? Or is the need the most greatest at the intro level, sort of?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. The need is the greatest at the intro level, because students, a lot of times they come into Arabic, they really have not much background knowledge. And even, I'll tell you, when they come in the classroom and they see me, they're wondering about me, because they have this image about who an Arabic instructor should look like. So that in itself is an initial shock to them. But then once we introduce to them even the diversity within the Arab world itself, and you know, that kind of helps them realize their own preconceived ideas. And yeah, and once we get to the advanced level, I feel like students really get it. Yeah.
How do you find out like where different students are from? I mean, surely as you go over time, you get friendly, you know, hey, where are you from? And so on. Do you have a systematic way of sort of learning about student backgrounds?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, especially in the beginning, our curriculum is developed on the student. It starts with the student. Like the first circle is the student. So we start by encouraging students to speak about themselves, their background, where they come from, all in a target language. So not only am I getting to know them and, you know, more about them, I'm, you know, helping them engage in the language. So, and they find it interesting because they're talking about the thing they know most about themselves, right? So through the language, I get to learn about the students. And from there, you know, we move to the outer circle, I say, you know, self, community, and so on, the world. Yeah.
Really interesting. I just realized, you know, when you start learning a new language, it's often, you know, I went to the store, or I live here, or, you know, just at the personal level. That's a really nice feature of instruction in the languages. Anyone else would like to speak up here?
One of the things we haven't touched on at all is teaching the sort of, you know, basic biology, organic chemistry, basic coding. I mean, classes like that, which are the giant 800-person classes, calculus, right? We haven't talked about that. I mean, I don't know if there's anybody on the call who can talk to something like that. Don would have been able to, I think. Or Brian, but I don't know, Sue, if you can.
Yeah, I mean, I've worked with the intro bio. I've taught the fairly large intro microbio class. And you know, part of it, I think, again, is at the faculty level, the faculty of these departments, understanding the importance of some of these issues. So you kind of lay the framework for reasons why, and then try to provide people with tools of how to. And I think in these classes, it could include a lot about presentation and a lot about who you're presenting as the role models for these fields. Mm-hmm. You know, are you picking people who come from a variety of backgrounds and highlighting some of the good work that people are doing? Most of these classrooms also have small discussion groups. So they may have two or three large lectures, but they almost all have small sections. And these sections are almost always taught by graduate or undergraduate students. And so I think the training of TAs is particularly important, because that's really where people are going to interact with individuals in the class. And so it's, I think, where a lot of that personal interaction is going to happen. And a lot of times these discussion groups will have activities that support the curriculum and the content, but they can support it in ways that address, you know, what were some of the cultural and historical issues at the time. I think it's important for students to know that science doesn't happen in a cultural vacuum, that there are a lot of things that go on that are, you know, good, bad, and ugly around science, and to help them understand what some of those forces are, because if they become scientists, they're going to be in a world where they're going to be affected by these cultural influences. And so I think there are ways of incorporating important concepts in these bigger classes. And I think a lot of that is going to have to sort of be either driven by individuals who teach these classes and embrace those concepts and appreciate their importance, or department chairs or departmental conversations that acknowledge the importance of some of these issues and then providing assistance for how to bring them into the classroom. And I know there are some efforts in a lot of these classes to already do some of these things. I think that would be a really interesting activity to survey some of the big intro bio classes and see what's happening. The other highlight, I think, is that a lot of these courses now have educational postdocs who are well-trained in some of the inclusive pedagogy. And I think they've had a huge impact in changing some of the, you know, the feel of the course and some of the teaching approaches. And so it'd be super interesting to see what they were doing.
What's an educational postdoc?
These are postdocs who are hired to incorporate active learning into the courses. There was a big push, mostly in arts and sciences, but also in CALS, to fund and hire postdocs to help faculty make their courses more active. And they also often do evaluation. And one of the things they're often in charge of is things like, what are we going to do in our small group discussions? What are the activities to help promote learning? So that even if the majority of the sort of lecture class time is people being talked to, that they still have opportunities to engage students. So they're trying to improve student engagement in these big lectures. And biology has a number of those postdocs, as do physics and econ and math and scattered courses throughout arts and sciences.
Who pays for these postdocs?
Anonymous funders. So people went out and did fundraising and got outside funding for all of them.
Wait, so there's a university-wide effort, or you're talking about selected departments did this?
I think originally it was offered to departments in arts and sciences, and then CALS had another round of proposals where we were funding projects, and then the last round was open to, I think, everyone in the college. Peter Lepage organized it through CTI, and I know it included arts and sciences and CALS. I'm not sure if it was widespread to the entire, to all the other colleges, but I think maybe yes.
Yeah, it's the one where physics and biology did a lot of work. I think it was just CALS and arts and science.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's pretty relevant because haven't talked about the center idea, but one model is the Society for the Humanities, and that to have a vibrant postdoc
program
with that overtone is an interesting possibility. So.
Sue, is this written up somewhere, or does one need to just contact you to get information more?
Which specifically, about the program of postdocs?
Postdocs, and even like, you know, the way in which it was married to large classes. I think it's a fascinating model.
There were a couple Cornell Chronicle articles that were summaries of it that were pretty good. And so that might be a place to start. I mean, I could see if I can find them quickly and post something in the chat if I can get my hands on it quick.
Okay.
If you get into the Cornell website and just Google in Active Learning Initiative or ALI, it'll come up with some.
Okay. Thank you, Don.
Okay, I think we've done a nice job here in the last hour, and it's a tricky topic, but we've gotten some really good ideas here. And again, I just felt that we have to try to have some sense of what's going on across campus, and I think we have a better sense. Okay, very good. So thank you, everybody. You can always email myself or Nima if you have follow-up questions or observations you'd like to share. We'll put the recording of this up on our website, and along with the chat and related references and so on. So thanks a lot, and I'm sure we'll be in touch in the next few months. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.